Good morning. In Yirtzeh Hashem, this coming Shabbos, we're going to read Parashat Tetzaveh. In addition to Parashat Tetzaveh, since it is the Shabbos before Purim, it is also Parashat Zachor. And the Mashnah is going to be the Parashat Zachor. Remember that which Amalek did to you, and that's going to be the subject of our Mashiach. The Mashnah of this Shabbos, Parashat Zachor, the Haftorah, is also going to deal with Amalek, because the Haftorah is the Parashat in Sefer Shmuel, full of chapter 15, where Shmuel, the Novi Shmuel, tells first king of Israel, Shaul, Levi Kita et Amalek, go and strike Amalek, and of course he does not fulfill the mitzvah the way he should have, and he it's one of the reasons why he loses his right in the kingdom. He had to destroy them completely, and he left Agag, king of Amalek, alive. And Agag, of course, was the Zeder of Amon Ha'agogi. Amon Ha'agogi. Years later, the one who's going to attempt to destroy the Jewish people comes from Agag. So here these psukim. Now we're going to see during the course of the shir that women certainly should hear the reading of Parashat Zachor. Though we will see maybe a bit of a difference of opinion, but I don't know. I think in most shuls there are special readings of the Torah of Parashat Zachor. We have one after davening, we have one before mincha, to make sure that we have all sorts of opportunities for women to hear the Parashat Zachor. If somebody simply cannot make it, and so don't feel too bad. There are a number of other opportunities to fulfill the mitzvah. One can have in mind to fulfill the mitzvah of remembering Amalek during the course of the reading of the Megillah. The Megillah also is a reminder of what Amalek is and what will happen to Amalek, so you can fulfill the mitzvah there too. But please, you should try to make it to shul. I mean, that's assuming, I don't know. When I'm preparing the shiur, I don't know what's going on in the world. Hardly. So somebody told me about that at the end of the week there's going to be rain and there's going to be snow. In other words, if they've cleared away the snow in Yerushalayim, the half a centimeter that may or may not fall, and you'll be able to make your way to shul. So please do that in order to hear Parashat Zachor. Parashat Zachor, the laughter of this coming Shabbos, comes from the end of Parashat Ketetzeh in Sefer Devarim. We're going to read the psukim and translate, because first of all, you have to know what it means. You have to know what it means in order to fulfill the mitzvah. It's not simply a matter of hearing them say Zachor et Asher Oso Lecha Amalek. You should know what it means. Zachor et Asher Oso Lecha Amalek Baderech Yetzeichem Mitzrayim. Remember that which Amalek did to you on the road when you're going out of Egypt. Asher Korcho Baderech. He happened upon you. Asher Korcho Baderech. I don't really like the word korcho so much. Happened upon you seems to leave the impression as though, you know, here Klal Yisrael are marching out of the sky, they're someplace in the desert, and Amalek just happens to be passing by. Oh, no. Amalek wasn't happening to be passing by. It was a premeditated sneak attack. As far as we are concerned, do you know what the attack is? I will borrow the words of FDR. A day that will live in infamy. Just like Pearl Harbor. An attack, premeditated, surprise. Asher korcha baderech. He went out there after you on the road. Vayizanei v'cho kol hanecholim acharecho. And he went after, vayizanei means to come from the back, behind. It comes from the word zanav, the tail. He went after the tail, the stragglers. He came from behind to attack. Kol hanecholim acharecho. All of the weak, the slow, those who are in the back, that's who he attacks. That's where Mali goes after. He goes after the ones who are unprotected. He's a big hero, Mali. Mali can start up with those who cannot defend themselves. And you are exhausted, you are committed, you are faint and exhausted. Yorev Elohim, and he did not fear God. Amalek did not fear God. Because here it is, at the end of the Shira, it says, Shamu Amin Yirgozum, the nations of the world heard what happened at the Red Sea, that all of Egypt were drowned in the sea. Shamu Amin, the nations heard, Yirgozum, they trembled. Kil Ochaz Yoshe Plushes. Fear gripped those who lived in Plishtim. And so can go on to describe how a whole world trembles before the God of Israel. And these fellas, Amalek, Mana, Lo Yarei Elokim, he's going to start up with God himself. V'haya.
Lo Yarei Elokim, is that not an ambiguous statement?
She's asking, "V'lo yarei Elokim," isn't that an ambiguous statement? In other words, you mean that it could be referring to the Jewish people? All right. So first of all, I would assume, when we look at the context, that whole pasuk is talking about Amalek. The pasuk is talking about Amalek. If all of a sudden the pasuk at the end switches to be talking about Israel, something should have been said. The pasuk is talking korcha baderech, that's Amalek. Vayizanei b'cho, who was vayizanei? It was Amalek. V'ata, you are oyev v'yogeya. So because now it switches to talk about you, so it could be understood as maybe the Jewish people as well. So therefore we have to assume the Farshim indeed say v'lo yarei Elokim. And we'll see it right away. Right away, we'll see the Malbim, what he has to say about it. It could be understood that way. And the fact is, in Parshat Bishalach, it says that they were in Rephidim when the attack happened. And they say Rephidim means Rochu Yadehem Midivrei Torah. Their study of Torah had weakened. So it could indeed be read both ways, but we'll see the Malbim. Anyway, my instinctive feeling is we don't, at this point, we don't want to find fault with the Jewish people. When they're under sneak attack from the enemy, the Jewish people are the finest in the world. We don't look for their evidence. Okay? So now, as a result of this sneak attack that took place so many years ago, it will take place when God is going to give you rest from all of your enemies, misaviv, all around. You're going to come into Eretz Yisrael. There's going to be a great deal of, war that will be waged, and you're going to have to, indeed defeat many nations. When all of that is over, then you, all of your attention should be focused on Amalek. When God is going to give you rest from all of your neighbors all around, but others. In that land, Asher Hashem Elokechon Otein Lecho Nachalo, that God, your God, gives you as an inheritance, L'rishta, as a heritage, L'rishta means more than machla. It's machla l'rishta that is to be passed on from generation to generation. Tinche et zeichen Amalek mitachat hashamayim lo tishkach. Wipe out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven, and we shall not forget. Okay, that's the parsha of Zechidas Mechias Amalek. So the point that we want to make in this year, we'll show it in a number of ways, is really number two. Number two is the first line in the first Mishnah in the second Perek of Masechet Megillah. Hakorei et HaMegillah L'machveya. Lo Yotza. Somebody who reads the Megillah L'machveya does not fulfill his obligation to read or to hear the Megillah. What does the word L'machveya really mean over here within the context of the halacha? What it really means is if you read it out of order, the Megillah is a story. Now a story, you have to begin from the beginning and go step by step through until you come to the end. If you're going to jump ahead or move back and it's not going to be in order, there's something seriously wrong with the story. So the means you have to read it by Yehi Bimei Achashverosh. Not Achashverosh Bimei by Yehi. You have to read the first chapter before the second, and the second before the third. You can't decide to read the third chapter and afterwards the second. Either psukim or parsha, it has to be in order. That's it. It has to be in order. The Baal Shem Tov gives a Hasidic interpretation of Hakodei et HaMegillah L'Machveya. And I'd heard it a number of times on the previous Lubavitch of Heaven, Sefer Tzavik L'Machveya. He said, Hakodei et HaMegillah L'Machveya, if somebody reads the Megillah and thinks that the entire message of the Megillah is about something that happened long ago and far away, hasn't fulfilled the mitzvah. If you think this is, there was once a sneak attack on the Jewish people, and we want that though that people and all of their descendants should be destroyed, but does not take the story of the Megillah and the mitzvah of Zechirat Mechiyat Amalek and see it within the context of his own life, hasn't fulfilled the thing. No, what it really means is that those who don't remember the lessons of history and the mistakes of history are doomed to make the same mistakes all over again. Today, the position in which we find ourselves today is most probably infinitely worse than what Jews faced in the desert. Certainly much worse than Haman in the days of Mordechai and Esther. Haman didn't have a chance of producing a nuclear bomb. Haman didn't have a concentration of 6 million Jews in one little piece of land. Haman had agents over 127 states in order to make sure that he's going to get his ends. And that many Jews. Hitler, yimach shemo v'zichro, had to collect Jews from all over Europe. We have a Haman today, and we're going to see, is this man serious? Is he a buffoon? Should we take whatever he says with a few grains of salt? Or maybe no. No grains of salt at all. Maybe we should take him by his word, which means, of course, that the largest Jewish community in the world is facing a real honest to goodness threat. And therefore we're going to have to learn from the story of Purim. What does the story of Purim have to tell us? What does the mitzvah of Zechidas Mechias Amalek have to say? So let's go. HaKoreas HaMegillah Masdeyek, one who reads the Megillah, one who reads the Megillah and thinks that it's something that happened to Masdeyek back there, once upon a time, and doesn't realize that the once upon a time is right now, is making a tragic mistake. Number three is the Malbim. The Malbim on these Pesukim in Devarim. And the fact is that the Malbim says this in two other places, and he's going to repeat it here. And he says the following. At the end of the first sentence, Kvar biarti b'pasuk, I have already explained in the Pasuk in Shmuel, that is in Haftorah, Shemulchemet amalek lo haya lo shum sipa mehasipot, he explained there, and he's going to explain it here, that the battle of Amalek against the Jewish people was not the result of any of the reasons that any people would ever wage war against another people. None. For example, Shekol Orchei Mulchamot Yiyeh Le'echod Mechamesh Sibot V'Kulam Lo Hayupo. All war that is waged between country A and country B for one of five reasons, and none of these five reasons existed here. Aleph, number one, Sheyilachem Al Eretz L'Kof Shehu. You wage war against the land in order to conquer it. Lebenschal, I want their land. Leharchivet vulo, in order that one should be able to expand their area. So one country will attack its neighboring country in order to conquer it. To conquer it. That wasn't true here. Klal Yisrael didn't have a country. We're out in the desert. Okay, number two. Really? Oh, the Zeho also. So he says, where do we see this? The Zeho Yavaderech. This attack took place on the road. Nobody is in their native land. Kibuhoyu was, and it's no Shabbat. They weren't at that time in an inhabited land. The second is, in Yikrav El Gvul Artso, Shehu Yadei Pen Yigashet Artso. It says, what happens if our land is not contiguous with the land of the Jews, but they're on the march and they're coming close to us? They are moving their troops up in order to attack us. Oh, because we're afraid of an attack by the Jews. So then, of course, you have a right to go out and defend yourself. But they weren't attacking anybody. We were just making our way through the desert. There was no threat. There was no threat to Amalek. That was number two. In Yikrav again, in Yikrav Gvul Artso, if the so-called enemy comes close to the boundary of his land, Shehu Yodei, Amalek is afraid, Yigashet Artso, maybe he's going to inherit and take their land, like the wars of Sichon and Og. But this wasn't true here, because that was Mitzaytcha Mitzrayim. You were nowhere near Amalek. Three. Im also ilonu chamavid garubo. If Israel would have indeed already waged war with Amalek and had incited him, so then they can fight back. But that wasn't true here, because korcha baderech, derech mikdeh. The Malm was learning, means you just happened to meet up with one another, not because Amalek didn't plan to attack, but it's all something that is not premeditated, because there was no reason for the war. There had been no attack. Nobody had waged war with anybody. Just two people that happen to be here in one place. There was no argument between the two. There were no issues between between Israel and Amalek. Number four, there are times that nations will go to war in order to flex their muscles. They want to show their strength. A nation will go out against another nation in order to show their strength and their might. But if you want to show your strength and your might, face to face combat. You don't go sneaking up in order to attack the weak and the stragglers in the back. Who? Because and now the Magnus says it. By the Samir Bakor Kol Hanach Sholima Kharako Bato Yefi Agea. He wasn't showing his might. On the contrary, he was showing that he was the only ones that he can start up with are the weak, the ones who are not protected. Israel didn't feel that they had to protect their flanks or their back or the Ochef, the home front. They didn't expect any kind of an attack. I've told you so often that the first memory of my childhood, was December 7th, 1941. I was 6 years old. Go do the mathematics, I don't care what you do. I was 6 years old, and I was one of the few young six-year-olds in America who was in yeshiva on that Sunday morning. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon or two, and principal came in, and it was a very cold day. Principal came in, and he whispered something to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe looks very, very worried. And when principal walks out, the Rebbe says, Kinderlach, get dressed. So you know what it means, getting dressed? The little boots and the coats and the shawls and the gloves. And then the Rebbe leads us out of the classroom, and then coming out of the classroom, this is Torah Vidas, Yeshiva Torah Vidas, 206 Wilson Street in Williamsburg. And we see all the other classes, they're coming down very, very, everybody was just in place. Nobody was rushing. The Rebbe took us down, came down to the street, we came out of the building, we turned left, to the corner of Lee Avenue and Wilson Street. On one corner was the candy store, the other corner was Flams. Flams was at the other corner, you remember? And the Rebbe said, Yingalach, Leifahang, run home. And we ran home, I can say this story already, you know, like in my sleep, and I come home and there are my father and mother sitting in front of a radio. She knows already these big wooden things over there, and the crackling, of course, and then for the first time in my life I hear about a place called Pearl Harbor, and there was fear that the Japanese would attack the mainland. Is attacking a sleepy Pearl Harbor on a Sunday morning, you understand, a Sunday morning. Well, it can also attack a Yom Kippur in the afternoon. There are people who've done that too. And then, number five. Now here you'll see what the Maram has to say about the Lo Yarei Elokim. Ba'avur Hadat, there are wars that are waged in the name of religion. Ba'avur Hadat, Shechoshev Shinsachem Be'nei Elohav Im Yachid Am Hadiltim Aminim Bo. There are those who will go out to war against others because the others are infidels. They don't believe in my God. And my God is going to be very happy with me if I strike down these unbelievers. You understand? Okay? The Crusaders and the Muslims, the Saracens and the Crusaders. You're still going to make a haggad over matters of religion. But that could not have been a Amalek's reason for attacking. Because below Yoreh, Elohim, he had no God. He wasn't a God-fearing man. There was no religion that he had. So the Bible says these are five possible reasons why people would go out to wage war against others. And none of them applied over here. None of them applied. So what's he saying? What does he mean to say? What's the maskan? What do we have to take away from this? You know what we have to take away from it? That it's irrational and illogical, and all anti-Semitism throughout the ages has always been absolutely irrational and illogical. And anybody who tries to say, well, they're attacking us because we build settlements. They attacked us before we built settlements. There wasn't a single settlement that I know of in Europe. No settlements. There's always some reason, but it's irrational and it's illogical. Now, once we take that step, that it's irrational and illogical, you know what the next step is? You can't talk with those who are illogical and irrational. And that's what the Torah is saying. Irrational evil has to be eradicated. Because there's no possibility, you can't negotiate, you can't talk. Nishtahanin kain in vit vissigains and tish. There's nobody to sit down with, there's nobody to talk to. Totally beyond the pale of the normal human discourse. So the only way you deal with irrational evil is destroy it. Yeah. That's the whole idea of Timcha and Zecher Amalek. Destroy Amalek. All right. We can go further. We have more to build up over here. In number four, so that's the Malvin. The Malvin is telling us great pshat in the Psukim. That there are five reasons why nations will lift up sword against other nations. And he lists them all. And the Torah says that none of these apply here. They didn't live near each other. They were not attacking one another. There had not been any kind of dispute between the two of them over anything. There was no way that Amalek would be showing his strength and his might, because he only attacked the weak. Understand? He blew himself up in a shopping center. That's real strength. Might.
Heroism.
Yes. Okay. Which therefore leads us to conclusion number one. All anti-Semitism is irrational and illogical. And anybody who attempts to give any reasons for it, like, if we would just be more forthcoming, you understand? If we would just, be nicer. You don't have to Jew everybody in the world. Okay, you have to be nice to people. If we'd be nicer, if we'd be good, if we'd be understanding, if we would be compassionate, there would be no chance. All that is sheker. It's false. No. Next. Number four. Number four is the Torah Tumima. The Torah Tumima, and I'm going to tell you, the Torah Tumima is on the halacha. First line with the Timcha. The halacha of erasing the memory of Amalek, afilu min ha'etzim va'avonim. It doesn't mean only to destroy the people, men, women, and children, but it means anything that would remind one of Amalek. If there's a pact, an Amaleki pact, destroy it. Anything that carries the name of Amalek, destroy it. Now this halacha is going to be very, very important, because the Torah Tumima here deals with another fascinating question. We're going to see on the next page, don't go there, yeah? On the next page, that according to the Sefer HaChinuch, the mitzvah of Zechirat Mechiat Amalek, to remember the evil of Amalek, is a mitzvah that applies to men only and not to women. So the Torah to me says, he doesn't understand that at all. The mitzvah of destroying Amalek does not apply to women, because women are not obligated to go to war. Destroying Amalek means waging war. Gemara says, Nashim are not benos milchama. They are not the ones who wage war. They keep the home fires burning, and the men are the ones who go out to war. But the Torah Tanima says over here, we're not talking about the mitzvah of destroying Amalek. We're talking about the mitzvah of remembering the evil of Amalek. Remembering the evil of Amalek? That has nothing to do with waging war. And if so, women should be obligated in that mitzvah just like anybody else. They should remember just as good as anybody else. They remember even better. They have long memories. And if you take a look at the... let's go down and you'll see the beginning of the third paragraph in the Torah Tumim of Onam. However, I need Tomei al Vav HaChinuch. I have a question on the Vav Sefer HaChinuch. Shehikiv binyan zeh shnei dvarim shonim. He mixed two things together that really never twain shall meet. They're not the same thing. They're two different things. What are the two different things? V'hu ki afilu inema, even if we say she'ein hanoshim mechuyavot v'mitzvat mechiyat Amalek, even if we will say that women are not obligated in the midst of destroying Amalek, and by the way, that may not always be true, because if it is milchemet mitzvah, if we're being attacked, then chosam mechupato v'kala mechupatan, go out to wage war. Some say may, it doesn't mean that they go out to wage war, for those who say if the chosam is leaving the chuppah to go wage war against an enemy that's attacking, so the kala, of course, she'll go take care of the home front. But whatever it is, he says there are two mitzvahs. One is the mitzvah of destroying, and the other is the mitzvah of remembering. Remembering applies to even if we say that noshim are not obligated to the mitzvah of mechiyat Amalek, avolein zeh nogeh, that has nothing to do with the mitzvah of zechirat Amalek, remembering Amalek. The Bezariah Parsha, this Parsha is talking not about destroying, this Parsha is the Parsha of Zachor. Remember what Amalek did. The Bezariah Parsha, Bazeh, the Badai, Shaykhim, Kam, Nashim, women are also equally obligated in the idea of remembering. V'halohu ba'atzmo v'chem yeter mo'ya mitzvot manu z'chidat Amalek u'mechiyat Amalek l'shtei mitzvot, in order to prove that what he's saying is correct, is all of those who listed the mitzvot, the number of mitzvot, they count them as two separate mitzvahs. Remembering and destroying is not one mitzvah. Remembering is one mitzvah, and destroying is the second mitzvah. Memela, if they're two separate mitzvahs, so yes, women are not obligated in the midst of destroying Amalek and waging war, but they are obligated in the midst of remembering. And therefore, he says, "Im ken mashayich mitzvah schidish alein lahav de'aimam v'nei kibush." What does the mitzvah of remembering have to do with the idea that women are not the ones who wage war? We're not talking about war over here, and certainly, the Torah Tumim is talking about the halacha of destroying even the pots and pans. Women can destroy pots and pans equally as men. You don't have to be a wager of war to destroy every last object that belongs to Amalek. So therefore he says, in the Dati, and in my opinion, Ein Sofik, there's no doubt, Shagam Hanoshim Chuyavot B'Mitzvot Zechirazu, K'kol Mitzvot Aseh She'en Hasman Grama. Women are obligated in the mitzvah Zechira, just like all other mitzvahs that are not bound by time. Because the fact is, you can fulfill the mitzvah any time during the course of a year, But we will see that Minhag Yisrael is to have a Shabbos on which we remember Amalek, and that's Parsha Zohar. Shaharei Zmano Haskia Parmachos Bishlono. We cannot say that this is a mitzvah that's dependent on a particular moment in time or connected to a moment in time, because you can put any time during the course of the year. Okay, number five. Number five is where we start intensifying our the idea that we want to express. Vayom Allah HaMelech. Esther comes into Achashverosh. The fact is, she has just placed her life on the line. She stands there at the entrance to his throne room, and she has not been invited to come. And what's the halacha? Anybody who comes uninvited, Archaz Dosol Vahonis, the Lord is that they be put to death, Levad, except for the one to whom the king is going to extend the golden scepter. And there Achashverosh sees her standing there, and he knows that she is right now risking her life. In a second she could be dead. So he's very curious. He extends the scepter of gold. I mean, may not be only that he's curious, I think he likes her. So then you can ask Akasha, why didn't he invite her for the last 30 days? Akasha, my mice, he was busy. All right? Vagomala HaMelech, the king said, Umalach Esther HaMalka, what do you want? What is it that you seek? Al Chatzito Malchus, until half of the kingdom betay us, and it will be done. What does this Al Chatzito Malchus mean? So the Gemara says the following. Chatzi ha-malchus v'lo kol ha-malchus. You can have half, but not the entire kingdom. The low, and of that half, lo dovar shechotzeitz l'malchut. Neither, you cannot have the thing which divides the kingdom, which is located in the middle of the kingdom. Umayimihu, and what was that? That refers to Binyan Beit HaMikdash. And we can expand that a little further. What it means is, don't ask me about Yerushalayim. When Koresh, king of Persia, gave Jews permission to go on Aliyah, they went and they began to build the city and the Beit HaMikdash. And then there were those who wrote letters of hatred, telling Koresh that city is a rebellious city. Don't let them build the city. And Koresh halted construction in Jerusalem. The first time in history, the first halt of construction in Jerusalem. And it wasn't for 10 months. Open-ended. No construction in Yerushalayim. That continued for 18 years. Achashverosh, who comes after him, extends the prohibition. No construction in Yerushalayim. Some fascinating reason, Yerushalayim is something of extreme significance to Achashverosh and to his entire government. They cannot build in Jerusalem. They cannot build in Jerusalem. Now, I'll have to see what this means. Somebody told me a few days ago that somebody here in class told him that he doesn't have to read the Jerusalem Post on Tuesdays because he gets the Jerusalem Post from me on Tuesday. So you know what I'm pulling today? Today you're going to have to read the Jerusalem Post, because I want to refer to something that was in the Post yesterday. Monday's Jerusalem Post. Monday's Jerusalem Post. We don't even pay attention to it. We don't even pay attention. How many years is it since Purim? About 2,500 years. But here there was the lead story, Monday, February 27th. 2012, fourth of order, 5772. In a speech in Doha, before the following group, there is going on now, I think it's still going on, the International Conference for Defending and Protecting Jerusalem. The International Conference for Defending and Protecting Jerusalem. You didn't know anything about it. What do you mean? The UN Center representative, you understand? Yerushalayim has never been freer in all of its history than it is now, you understand? But Jordan made a deal with us in 1948 that Jews would be able to go to the Kotel, they would be able to go to Har HaZeisim. Vesechvas never kept it for one moment. And listen, you know, of course, that there's a struggle about Har HaZeisim too. I was one of those who was there Friday as the conference of presidents of our visit to Har HaZeisim, and we saw areas where there are broken tombstones, you understand, in Eretz Yisrael. We're not talking about cemeteries in France or in Poland or anyplace else. Har HaZeisim, right over here. Who doesn't have a relative buried over there? My father is buried there. My in-laws are buried there. And there are broken tombstones. There's one section of Har HaZeisim that is right next to Isawiya, yes, and some other Arab villages, and they move through Har HaZeisim like it's theirs, you understand? There's a real struggle. I was also there when we were pelted with stones. The paper said one stone. I happened to hear about four or five. One of them fell just a few feet from where I was, but it's all right. I don't want to leave the impression that I'm the big hero who was there, and I made my way through that. But it just happened at the right time that they threw stones and people are afraid to go to Har HaZeisim. So here it is, there's an international conference about Yerushalayim. The whole world is concerned about Yerushalayim, when it has been safer for the whole world and all religions now than it ever was. So nothing has changed in 2,500 years. Central to the story of Purim is the story of Yerushalayim. The Purim story is the struggle. I once called it a tale of two cities, Shushan and Yerushalayim. And you know what's fascinating about it? What's fascinating about it is 2,500 years ago, when our rabbis established 2 days of Purim. So the Gemara talks, you know, the second day was a miracle in the city of Shushan. In the city of Shushan, they fought for a second day. In the whole world, they fought on the 13th of Adar, and they rested on the 14th. In Shushan, they fought on the 13th and the 14th, and they rested on the 15th. So obviously, the second day of Purim should have been Yud Dalet, the 14th, for the whole world, and in Shushan on the 15th. But our rabbis, God bless them, they understood anything that you're going to establish that is rooted in Chutz Laretz is bound to be lost forever. There ain't no Shushan. Long gone. There's no Shushan. But they wanted to establish the idea that Jews fought for a second day. So you know where they did it? The HaNetzach. The Gemara in Brachah says, Netzach, eternity, Zu Yerushalayim. If you make the mitzvah Yerushalayim, then you can have a mitzvah forever. And we're going to celebrate the Yetz Hashem a week from Friday. As the rest of the world do whatever they want on Thursday, we're going to have Purim on Friday. I always love it. It's one of the great days. The 14th of Adar in Yerushalayim is one of those lazy days. It's a wonderful, a beautiful day. There's nothing like it. And then those poor people in Tel Aviv, they have to extend Tainus Esther, fast their way through the Megillah, And of course, you get very upset. For years, I got upset with the little kids. They're clapping, humming, and I'm hungry. It's nice to clap. We have to go and eat. But you know what? But it did help in a certain respect. You began to hate Haman more than you ever hated it before. Noch Haman, another clapping. The neshuma cake noise away. But now, Yerushalayim. Thursday, very late afternoon, go to Mincha, sit around and schmooze a little bit, and show on a full stomach, you hear the Megillah. Great invention. By the way, just like it's worthwhile to come on Aliyah, to have only one day, Yom Tov, it's worthwhile moving to Yerushalayim to have the 15th. That's all. Alright. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Story about Ahasuerus, the not wanting to give to Esther the whole kingdom.
Yeah.
Does that mean he had an inkling that she was Jewish?
Yes, everything.
She's asking, does this mean, if he's ready to give a half of the kingdom, does it mean that he thinks that she's Jewish? There's no indication whatsoever. I think he's just being, you know, he's being so nice to her. She knows he doesn't mean a word of it. He's not giving her no chatzi amalchus. No, there's no way. He doesn't know a thing. Yes?
It says Zohar, why remember? Why does it say at the end of the pasuk,
So you're answering the Gemara's question. It says Zachor. You remember. Why does it say at the end, Lo Tishkach? You shall not forget? That's what Kriyas HaMegillah is all about. One is not to forget in your head. The other is Al Tishkach Bepeh. You have to say it out. And you know when you say it out? Reading Parsha Zohar. That's where we fulfill the mitzvah. Prepare and believe. It has to be expressed verbally. All right, we got so much to do. We're very hard on all this. You know what I'm going to do. The next page or two pages are the chinuch. The mitzvah Zohar, I'm going to skip that. You know, don't have to learn Kala Torah Kula. But I'm going to take you to the last page, last two pages. It says over there, selections from A Lethal Obsession by Robert Wisrich. About a year ago, more than a year ago, we read some sections of that great book. I told you about the book. Robert Wisrich is a professor in Hebrew University. He is the world's expert on anti-Semitism, and he has written many, many books. But of course, The Lethal Obsession is not even anymore his most recent one. The Lethal Obsession was published at the end of 2010, the beginning of 2011, just about a year ago. With the footnotes, it's over 1,000 pages. I say it's certainly one of the heaviest books that I ever bought. It cost me 259 shekels, Steinmetzkis, and it's 259 shekel. And I just want to take you through a number of things, because what it's related to, you'll see right away what it's all related to. The purpose of the shir, I said, is that the story of the Megillah is not lemafreyam, not something that happened long ago and far away. The mitzvah of the Megillah is right now. Us, me, you, all of us. And that message has to get across. Now, take a look at A. You can immediately recognize why I chose this selection. You know how difficult it was to choose? All of these selections are taken from the last chapter of the book. The last chapter of the book is entitled Ahmadinejad and the Last Jihad. The Last Jihad. You're going to learn a number of things. You know what? Let's just read. I don't think I have to say pshat. Ahmadinejad's obsessive hatred of Israel transcends normal politics. and has no empirical basis. It's not based in reality. Iran and Israel do not even share a common border. No. Tell me, what do you hear in this sentence? There's the mountain. There are no territorial or economic issues between the two nations. Lachamol the mountain. Israeli leaders some time ago conceded the principle of a Palestinian state, Nabah, providing that it will dismantle all terror organizations, accept peaceful coexistence, and fully normalize its relations with the Jewish state. For the Iranian leadership, such considerations are totally irrelevant. We don't care. They don't care at all. Hating Israel is an end in itself. Is it irrational? Is he saying it's irrational and it's illogical? You know what it means? You can't, there's nothing to negotiate about. You'll give up your the settlements. You'll decide that convenience. The Eibishter will make sure there will not be a Palestinian state. But that doesn't make any difference to them. Because the whole hatred of Israel is an end itself. It also provides a common enemy that can unite rulers and rule. Demonizing the Jewish state offers a plausible pretext for developing nuclear weapons, while at the same time it attracts the sympathy of the Arab street. He has a great deal to gain from this irrational hatred of his. He has an excuse now to go ahead and build his nuclear weapon because he knows who knows what those Jews are going to do. And it, of course, unites the people of Iran. Life is not good in Iran. Not good at all. Well, we'll see. We'll see much more. Okay. Last sentence. Above all, for Ahmadinejad, the war against America and Israel belongs to the end of days perspective. It is an eschatological battle of destiny. We're going to see Ahmadinejad belongs to an extreme religious group. And his Rebbe, Mahdi and Mazdi, you're going to read about them, we're going to see about them. These people have an idea that we are closely, quickly approaching the end of days when there's going to be a great war in the world. Now, you know, sometimes you have to help prophecy along, you know. There are going to be great wars, a lot of people killed, and he believes this. The Emunah Shlema, he believes it. And that the end is that Islam is going to destroy the Jews and the Christians. And he wants to do it. He believes this, the Emunah Shlema. For Yazdi was his Rebbe. B, for Yazdi and his followers, there can be no greater blasphemy than the Jewish or Christian evangelical belief that God will fulfill all his promises to the people of Israel as set out in the Hebrew Bible, including the building of the third temple. This is a nethna to Ahmadinejad. It cannot be. His Rebbe said so. The Islamic apocalypse proceeds from completely opposite premises since it seeks to erase the Solomonic and Herodian temples from any connection to Jewish or Christian history. How many times have we seen this taking place in the last 15, 20 years? The only thing that got Clinton upset at Camp David with Barak was when Arafat told him there was never a temple of Solomon on the Temple Mount. They want to erase completely any connection that Jews have with this country. This is a basic thrust of their religion. And the best way to make sure that there is no Jewish claim is get rid of the Jews. It treats Islam as the culmination and supersession in a quasi-Hegelian sense. What it means, I don't know what it means. But I don't have to know what stuff in parentheses means. In Islamist end times, total opposition to Israel as the Satan of our age demands either the killing of Jews or their expulsion in order to repossess Al-Quds. Jerusalem, we're Al-Quds. How about it? They want us all out of here. They want to destroy us. There's nobody to talk to. There's nobody at home. In the Iranian case, the Mahdist event the Machta, or the Mahdi, is the Moshiach that is soon to come, the Islamic Moshiach, the Mahdi. And I think the Mahdi also, it's a second coming. It's very fascinating how these three major religions, each two of them borrow from the other. Yeah. We didn't borrow from anybody. We came before them all. But the point is, they borrow. Not only they borrow, they made up their this Mahdi. They say, we got to watch out for this Mahdi. And Ahmadinejad believes in the imminent coming of the Mahdi. What? In the Iranian case, the Mahdi is the event that reorders the world, specifically linked to the elimination of Zionism, Israel, and any Jewish influence. This perception has been heightened by the Shia awakening and Iranian dreams of dominating the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. We'll have to talk one of these days yet about the difference between the two major strains in Islam, the Sunnis and the Shiites. Freidnish. The interrelationship between Hezbollah and Hamas with Iran and with Syria. Syria are Alawites, Iran and the others are Shiites. Sunnis happen to be the majority. I sound like I know what I'm talking about, huh? You can't imagine what 5 minutes on Wikipedia can do for you. You find out anything you want, just Google Sunni and Shia Freik at the Shigibet. But these people believe it all. That's what's important. We can't walk around thinking that this guy is Stalin, the Shogun, nothing. What do you mean he's nothing? This is a Malik. President, let's go to C. C. Ahmadinejad's speeches can no more be considered as empty threats than the words of Adolf Hitler on January 30th, 1939, mm-hmm. prophesying that a new world war would bring about the annihilation of the Jewish race in Europe. The same genocidal intent is plainly there. Same thing is true now. The threat has been consistently repeated since October 2005. He has been saying Israel will be removed, Israel will be destroyed. Saying it time and time again. We think that, you know, this is our Charlie Chaplin over there. Well, who is he? What is he? He's a Charlie Chaplin who holds nearly within his grasp the most awesome firepower that the world has ever known. Now, I don't know if I'm going to have many words of comfort for you today, but if you come back next week, we'll tell you precisely how much to worry and how much not to worry. Well, let me finish C. One moment. The threat has been consistently repeated since October 2005. The alibis forged in advance by some Western commentators that the Iranian leader is politically immature. You hear? Some of the crazy guys, most probably Thomas Friedman, fits into this category. They've given alibis that the Iranian leader is politically immature, a novice, or a radical hothead indulging in empty bluster, are not borne out by the evidence. Now, this is the Gottlob Bedorenu on anti-Semitism. This is Robert Lisch. The ascendancy of Ahmadinejad, a child of the Iranian Revolution, is closely connected with that of the Basiji. You gotta read to the end of this paragraph. It'll give you an insight that you never had. The mass movement initiated by Khomeini in 1979 and militarized during the Iran-Iraq War, Iranian children, some as young as 12 years old, were sent to the front lines, enthusiastically marching in formation across minefields toward the Iraqi enemy, clearing a path with their exploding bodies. These children were part of a volunteer militia called the Basij Mostazafan, mobilization of the oppressed. The regime cruelly sent them toward their destruction. human sacrifices brainwashed by the regime into believing that they were heading straight to paradise. Let me ask you, what kind of compassion do you think they would have for the most hated enemies of the world, the Jewish people? Go ahead, kid. Yeshua Hashem, I'm ready to predict, and I'm going to try and prove it next week. We're going to see Nisim v'Niflos. And I have a sneaky suspicion that the Nisim v'Niflos are already in the works. There was some report today, I don't want to say anything about this paper, but I said, not this paper, but there's something that there may be all sorts of nuclear facilities that are no longer functioning. But wait a minute, next week is Tuesday, the 4th. Okay, so go to shul for Parshas Zohar.